Today is Friday, February 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Lori London in Washington. Thousands of passengers are being held on yet another cruise ship over coronavirus concerns.
You've got a cruise ship with thousands of people docked out in the water waiting to get tested before they could disembark all those people. That's unprecedented.
Another Democratic presidential contender drops out of the race, but isn't ready to endorse anyone just yet.
Let's take a deep breath and spend a little time on that. We don't have to decide that this minute.
And the International Criminal Court authorizes an investigation into possible war crimes in Afghanistan. It's all on today's International Edition.
Citizens across the globe are preparing for long-term disruptions from the new coronavirus. The AP's Charles de Ledesma reports.
The virus's unrelenting speed has brought ballooning infections, economic fallout, and sweeping containment measures. In places around the globe, a split has developed. China has been issuing daily reports of new infections that are drastically down from their highs. Factories are gradually reopening, and there's a growing sense that normalcy might not be far off. Meanwhile, countries elsewhere are seeing escalating caseloads and a litany of cancellations, closures, travel bans, and supply shortages. The WHO says there are about 17 times as many infections outside China as in it. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In California, authorities confirmed a third case of novel coronavirus from a passenger who traveled on the Grand Princess cruise ship last month from San Francisco to Mexico. One person from the cruise has died, while the two others infected are being treated at a hospital in Sonoma. A Coast Guard helicopter delivered test kits to the ship, which will not be allowed to dock until all 3,500 passengers are tested. California Governor Gavin Newsom told KOVR-TV that the new cases being detected throughout the state and the potential for hundreds more from exposure to those infected, that the decision is out of an abundance of caution.
To provide ample opportunity for the CDC, partnership with Coast Guard and with state health officials to conduct tests, because we have a number of passengers and crew members that have developed symptoms on this cruise.
Former FEMA senior official Mark Naval tells KGO television the situation on the Grand Princess cruise ship is highly unusual.
You've got a cruise ship with thousands of people docked out in the water waiting to get tested before they could disembark all those people. That's unprecedented.
Well, elsewhere in the United States, the number of confirmed cases of the COVID-19 virus in New York doubled overnight on Wednesday. So far, there have been 12 confirmed fatalities in the U.S., most of them in the state of Washington. World Health Organization Director or General Doctor Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says he worries some nations are not putting COVID-19 at the top of their agendas.
We're concerned that in some countries, the level of political commitment and the actions that demonstrate that commitment do not match the level of the threat we all face.
And he says there is no time to waste.
This is not a time for excuses. This is a time for pulling out all the stops. Countries have been planning for scenarios like this for decades. Now is the time to act on those plans.
South Korea declared a special care zone Thursday around a second city hit hard by the coronavirus, and the U.S. military confirmed two new cases among relatives of its troops in the country, which is battling the biggest outbreak outside of China. In all, South Korea has over 6,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Sinchanji, a religious group many hold responsible for the outbreak in South Korea, donated $10.1 million to help in the nationwide fight against the coronavirus. But what is it like living and working in South Korea during this epidemic?
My name is Dayun Lee. I am a licensed clinical neuropsychologist and currently am a research professor at Seoul National University Biomedical Research Institute. I'm the psychologist leading the dementia clinic at the neuropsychiatric department of Seoul National University Hospital. And I am a mother of 4-year-old and 2-year-old girls. Right now in the hospital, I feel like is the most sanitized place to be in Korea. We do see a lot of cancellations for the appointments. They're postponing their visits for Alzheimer's patients, the older adults, which I think is a good idea because I would highly recommend them to be not going to any places that would expose them to higher risk. So things are going as usual. We're trying to do that. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, very difficult to function. In terms of work, I wouldn't say work is harder. It would be more of, as a working parent with two toddlers. So that's the most difficult part because there isn't places to, you know, send our girls to spend the day, you know, like the schools, kindergarten's closed, daycare is closed, even though the education department or the district ministry of education, I think that's the correct term, but ministry of education came up with some sort of plan that there is going to be an emergency care for these kids who need them, but people are not, the parents are concerned to send their children to this emergent care because first, quality of care is questionable because we don't know who's gonna be the caregiver of this emergent care of the children. The second point, which is most frustrating for me actually, is the duration of the day in which our children can be taken care of by this emergent care program is very limited. Some schools, some kindergartens say it's only from 9 a.m. to noon, which really wouldn't help any working mom because, you know, even if they cut their day in half for them to commute back to their home, pick up their children, there's no way that they can do that. So this plan, I am appreciative of their effort and coming up with some sort of plan and that their recognition of the need to have a plan, but the applicability of it is just kind of, I don't know, very disappointing. As a cohort, as a nation, I think we're learning to deal with these kind of epidemic, you know, it's not pandemic yet, but this kind of issue as a country, as a nation together. And one of the aspects is that people are more aware and of personal hygiene. It is hard for people living through it, but we're not, you know, going overly dramatic about issues. We're trying to find a way to live our daily lives in the midst of all these things.
Well, she was the last woman standing, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was at one point a strong contender in the Democratic presidential primary race, officially dropped out on Thursday. Warren made the decision after a poor showing in Tuesday's 14 primary contests.
I will not be running for president in 2020, but I guarantee I will stay in the fight for the hardworking folks across this country who have gotten the short end of the stick over and over.
At a news conference Thursday, Warren says she's sorry to disappoint her supporters, especially all the girls with whom she made pinky swears that they would run for office one day.
One of the hardest parts of this is all those pinky promises and all those little girls who are going to have to wait 4 more years.
Michael Bloomberg, who dropped out a day earlier, is planning to form an independent group to help elect whoever becomes the Democratic presidential nominee in November, fulfilling a vow to put his $60 billion personal fortune to defeat President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, there are concerns that neither of the two frontrunners, Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden, will head into the Democratic convention with enough delegates, which could make for a messy nominating process. Our next guest says the root of the problem is a primary contest dominated system for selecting delegates to the national party nominating conventions and could lead to what might be described as a delegate debacle if neither candidate gets enough delegates to cross the finish line. That would leave it to so-called superdelegates, who are often made up of so-called establishment moderates. This could pose a conflict and resentment-filled decision from the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
Joining us now to talk more about this very thing is Mark Rosell, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia. Thank you for being with us. You recently wrote an article on this very topic, sounding a bit of an alarm. Explain your concerns and why you decided to write the article.
The reason I wrote about this is because there was a significant rules change after the 2016 Democratic Party National Convention that eliminated the role of the individuals who are known as the superdelegates on the first ballot at the 2020 National Democratic Party nominating convention. Now, let me just back up a little bit. Superdelegates have always been these discretionary agents at the National Party Convention, party leaders for the most part, who can vote as they please at the convention for whichever candidate they want for the presidency. They are not bound by the votes that took place in the primaries and caucuses preceding the convention. And that means that if, for example, no one has a majority of delegates coming out of the primaries and caucuses and therefore does not have a first ballot nomination, the superdelegates can come in and they can tip the balance one way or the other. Now, prior to this election cycle, about 15% of the delegates to the Democratic Party National Convention were superdelegates. Bernie Sanders objected at the 2016 convention, and he and his delegates fought for a rules change, which they eventually got, which eliminated the superdelegates from having any role at all on the first ballot. So if, for example, Bernie Sanders were to go into the Democratic National Convention with a lead in the delegate count, he would not get a first ballot nomination if he did not secure a majority of the delegates by that time. That would mean on the second ballot, the superdelegates can come in and vote, and they could decide not to pick Bernie Sanders. That's a real danger for the Democratic Party, because Sanders is making the argument, as anyone can understand, that whoever gets a majority should be the nominee. Whoever gets the most delegates should be the nominee, whether or not they get a majority on the first ballot.
Are the rules now, are you saying, favoring not having the superdelegates' ability to pick the president?
Right. So the superdelegates have, as of this year, for the Democrats, no role at all on the first ballot at the National Party Convention. And that means that if, for example, Bernie Sanders has the most delegates but not a majority, then he will not secure a first ballot nomination, because he needs to secure, or Joe Biden needs to secure, a majority of the delegates, not simply the most delegates, going into the convention in order to secure a first ballot nomination. If no one secures a first ballot nomination, it then goes to the second ballot. On the second ballot, the superdelegates come in, and now they have the right to vote. So this was the danger I was pointing out for the Democrats, right? If Bernie Sanders gets more delegates going into the convention than, say, Joe Biden, but he never secures a majority, which would guarantee a first ballot nomination, then the convention goes to a second ballot vote with the superdelegates coming in. And then it's all bets are off, because we don't know what the superdelegates will do. You know, at that point, they would have two choices. They could say, we're not going to go with the candidate who got the most votes in the primaries. We're going to go with the guy who we think would be a better general election candidate. We're picking Joe Biden. Or they can say, we're going to go with the Democratic will of the people. Bernie Sanders got more votes and he got more delegates, so we're going to give it to him. Or it could be a split decision among many superdelegates. There's over 700 of them. And again, anything could happen, and we could go even into multiple ballots for the nomination at that point.
It sounds pretty convoluted, like either side is going to be unhappy with what happens.
Well, I think that's right. That's the problem. And I think that's the real danger for the Democrats, because the Bernie Sanders people, they believe that they were badly treated in 2016, given the fact that there were superdelegates who all declared for Hillary Clinton at the beginning of the election cycle, before there were any primaries or caucuses, which inflated her lead early on and created the perception of the inevitability. of her nomination. So the Sanders people wanted that rule change in time for the 2020 nomination race in case Bernie Sanders were to run for president again, which, of course, he is doing. So now he has a rule change in place that gives him some advantage he would not have had otherwise.
What would be the best case scenario to avoid this kind of semi-crisis at the Democratic convention?
The best case scenario for the Democrats would be to settle the nomination process on the first ballot, and that would mean that one of the leading candidates, presumably either Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden, would win a substantial number of primaries going forward from now and secure enough delegates to have a majority on the first ballot at the convention. And so going into the convention, we would know who the party nominee is. There is no question about it. And there is no issue regarding the role of the superdelegates because they simply don't come into play.
All right. That's Mark Rosell, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University.
The U.S. Special Representative for Iran said Thursday the Islamic Republic must immediately ensure inspectors have access to sites that harbor traces of nuclear material or activity. In one of two confidential reports, the International Atomic Energy Agency identified three locations where Iran possibly stored undeclared nuclear material or conducted activities without declaring them to international observers. The IAEA said its requests to access the two sites have been denied.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has again fallen short of a parliamentary majority with his hardline allies. Final election results confirmed on Thursday that extended the country's year-old political deadlock and weakened the longtime leader as he prepares to go on trial for corruption charges. A final count announced by the Election Commission determined that Netanyahu's Likud party with his allies captured just 58 seats, well short of a 61-seat majority. Monday's election was the country's third in less than a year.
Markets in the United States and Europe closed lower Thursday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ all ended the day down lower by at least 3.5%. Shares fared better in Europe, with the Euro stocks, FTSE and DAX, down about a percentage and a half percent. Asian shares climbed on Thursday, but started off trading lower Friday.
OPEC agreed Thursday to cut oil output by an extra 1.5 million barrels per day in the second quarter of 2020 to support prices that have been hit by the coronavirus outbreak, but made its action conditional on Russia and others joining in. Reuters reporter Yahira Hakez reports.
The world's top oil producers on Thursday agreed to deeper production cuts in a desperate effort to offset a slump in demand caused by the coronavirus outbreak.
We now convene at a time when the outbreak of COVID-19 has had a pronounced adverse impact on economic and oil demand forecast in 2020, particularly in the first and second quarters. This underscores the fact that events in the oil markets are subject to uncertainties beyond the capacity of any individual stakeholder to manage on their own.
Meeting in Vienna, members of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, known as OPEC, agreed to cut oil output by an extra 1.5 million barrels per day, while extending existing cuts of 2.1 million, which were set to expire this month. But the deal is conditional on Russia and others joining in. Saudi Arabia, the biggest OPEC producer, and other member states have struggled to persuade Russia to support the move. Oil prices, which have tumbled by a fifth this year due to a glut in supplies, now made worse by the coronavirus outbreak, were volatile on the news. The proposed cut, if approved, would be OPEC's deepest since the 2008 financial crisis.
Reuters reporter Yahira Hakez. And coming up,
the United States has sharply criticized the International Criminal Court's decision to authorize an investigation into possible war crimes allegedly committed in Afghanistan, including those that might have been carried out by U.S. forces.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Disturbances on the sun have the potential to wreak havoc with Earth's power grids and communication equipment. A new study by biologists at Duke University in North Carolina and an astronomer from the Adler Planetarium in Chicago suggests that solar storms could also mix up the navigational abilities of whales, causing them to be stranded or beached on land. Scientists have found that some animal species can detect Earth's magnetic field and use it as a kind of GPS to navigate their migrations. The study's authors say that solar storms could be disrupting signals from that magnetic field. They suspect radio frequency noise created when high-energy solar particles smack into the magnetic field could be overpowering the whale's senses. It would be like turning off their GPS during the middle of their journey. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller, along with my colleague, Lori London. Russia and Turkey agreed to a ceasefire deal Thursday in Syria's Idlib region after talks between Vladimir Putin and Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Moscow. Reuters' Matthew Laritonda reports.
As part of the ceasefire agreement, Russian and Turkish troops will conduct joint patrols together in Idlib. But this isn't the first time they've done joint patrols there, nor is it the first ceasefire. Syria has gone through several ceasefires. All have collapsed. And while Putin expressed his condolences for the deaths of Turkish troops, both sides have blamed each other in the past for failure to coordinate and avert such events. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan says his country reserves the right to respond to any attack by forces loyal to Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. In the meantime, he says Turkey and Russia will work together to supply humanitarian aid. The civilian toll has been profound. The United Nations believes the fighting in Idlib has sparked what may be the worst humanitarian disaster of the 9-year war.
That was Reuters reporter Matthew Laritonda.
The United States has sharply criticized the International Criminal Court's decision to authorize an investigation into possible war crimes allegedly committed in Afghanistan, including those that might have been carried out by U.S. forces. Lisa Bryant has details.
Thursday's ICC appeals court decision overrules an earlier ruling last year that rejected opening a war crimes probe in Afghanistan on grounds it was unlikely to lead to successful prosecution. But presiding appeals court judge Piotr Hofmanski said the earlier ruling was wrong in concluding an investigation would not serve the interest of justice.
The appeals chamber considers it appropriate to amend the appeal decision to the effect that the prosecutor is authorized to commence investigation in relation to alleged crimes committed on the territory of Afghanistan in the period since 1 May 2003, as well as other alleged crimes that have a nexus to the armed conflict in Afghanistan.
The ICC prosecution's request to formally probe war crimes and crimes against humanity during Afghanistan's long-running civil war targets not only abuses allegedly linked to the Afghan government and Taliban, but also to the U.S. intelligence and military. The United Nations has documented thousands of civilian killings over the years that it says were authored by all three parties. Reacting from Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the ruling a reckless decision. He said the Trump administration will take all necessary measures to protect U.S. military and other personnel from being investigated.
This is a truly breathtaking action by an unaccountable political institution masquerading as a legal body.
The U.S. is not a member of the ICC, but Afghanistan joined the court in 2003. Washington previously argued such an investigation would threaten U.S. sovereignty and that the ICC has no jurisdiction over U.S. nationals. Last year, Washington imposed travel restrictions against ICC employees. But rights groups welcomed the ruling, saying it met the ICC's mandate as court of last resort.
And that's especially important in Afghanistan, where brutal cycles of impunity have, in essence, left them without any other recourse.
Parampreet Singh is Associate International Justice Director at Human Rights Watch. She acknowledges the investigation won't be easy.
But again, I think, you know, this opens up the opportunity for justice to be done eventually. What does that look like? I wish I could tell you. I don't know. But what I do know is that, you know, victims have reason to hope that at the very least, there's a court that's in their corner that will fight for the justice that's eluded them for so long in Afghanistan.
The ICC ruling follows a recent agreement signed by the United States and the Taliban aimed to end years of war. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Clashes have flared up again in northeastern Greece as authorities there try to stem the flow of migrants pouring in from Turkey after the Turkish government opened its borders last week. Greek police have been using tear gas, water cannons, and stun grenades to push back the border crossers. And Turkey is accusing Greek forces of shooting and killing at least four migrants, a charge that Greece denies.
Just a small town girl. Living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
Iconic lyrics in an iconic song, but for a longtime bassist Ross Valori and drummer Steve Smith, it is time to stop believing. Journey's Neil Sean and Jonathan Cain fired the duo and have accused them of trying to gain control of the band's name.
Now, in a California lawsuit, lawyers for Sean and Kane said Valerie and Smith tried to gain control of one of the band's companies, believing that if they controlled that company, they'd have the rights to the Journey trademark and thus millions of dollars. In addition to kicking Valerie and Smith out of Journey, Sean and Kane are suing for damages in excess of $10 million.
It goes on and on.
That's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling, thank you so much for listening.
You know, be sure to visit our website. You can do so and find in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time. I'm Steve Miller.
And I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day and a great weekend.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McKinney.